cannot have war without racist demonization of the quote-unquote enemy. So that's the context that really puts whether somebody is Southeast Asian or Vietnamese or Filipino, they fall into this category of a people who's being branded as this internal enemy. So if we don't have that context, then we're going to believe the MSNBC and CNN headlines that these are just individual racist attacks, when in fact it's part of something much bigger.
What about that NEDFA, what Danny just said about that demonization? And he was talking, of course, on an international level, but even locally. I mean, if we look at what's happening inside the states, there are some analysts who talk about that this technique that is being used is the divide and conquer, divide the people, divide them into racists, divide them into whatever you can divide them into, in order that they cannot unite and actually really make a change in the system. What do you think about that side of things?
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's absolutely true. You can't have it without having even domestic, propaganda to confuse people. In fact, I alluded a couple times to this Washington Wall Street Journal article that talked about what it was doing was demonizing language and woke, saying, accusing China and a media thing of using woke language, as it said, to confuse create racial tensions in the United States and animosity, as if there's not racism here already. And a way of saying that social justice movements are being influenced by outside agitators is that whole trope that's longstanding in the United States. Just like they did with, they did the same thing with Russia, and saying these little insignificant social media posts were aggravating tensions in the United States, as opposed to the actual real root problem itself being the cause of the unrest here. And so what is that? That's to divide us, some attempt, and I will say it's a feeble attempt. I don't think it will work, but a feeble attempt to accuse those of us who are on the ground talking about racial justice of being influenced by something else and not having the intelligence to know the difference between what really ails us and afflicts us, as opposed to these other messages, so-called messages that are supposed to be coming from somewhere else.
Well, Danny, your take, how do you see the future in the United States? Because you talked about these growing movements and these demonstrations and more young people having more of an international perspective. Do you see the future, basically, the pendulum swinging as far as the amount of people who are aware and being able to make a change in that system? Or do you see the system just crumbling, basically, because it won't make the changes that these young people and others are demanding?
Yeah, a study showed that 43% of young people in the U.S. look favorably upon socialism. I think there's more and more international solidarity every day with different struggles in the global south, whether it's in Haiti or in Nicaragua and Cuba and Venezuela. One-third to one-fourth of humanity lives under the suffocating sanctions of the empire. So it is upon us for the pendulum to swing. It won't be delivered by UPS or from on high, from without. It is incumbent upon us to organize this movement through popular education, to oppose it every moment, ruling class ideology, all of the ugliness and backwardness and white supremacy that seeps through this miseducational system, this mainstream corporate media. So there's a lot of work in front of us, and how important for everyone out there to join an organization, join study groups, and to be a part of this history, because all of humanity and the future of the planet depends upon it.
Ned, for your take, what do you think it's going to take to bring about the necessary change in that country?
You mean in the U.S.?
Yes.
I agree with exactly what Danny said, and I think it's that the most impacted, the most people that are facing the most disparaging impacts of this system, unjust capitalist racist system, need to be organized, and the particularly working class people of non-white working class need to be at the lead of that struggle, making unity with the broader working class in the United States. And then we also, I'll just say this, is we also have to, they're doing their best in the previous example that we mentioned, doing their best to disparage other forms of media information because they're not, it's a desperate attempt because they know people are realizing they can't depend on these corporate forms of information. So they want to disparage other folks. So, you know, like we mentioned, the Wall Street Journal's attempt. So we have to be able to look at other outlets like this one, like the media outlet right here. None of these corporate things will have Danny or I on here or anybody else talking about this topic the way we're talking about it. And so we have to look for other forms of information, and like Danny said, we also have to engage in collective popular education, political education, not just consuming the information, but getting together so we can have an interpretation of the information that we're getting to inform our organizing.
Thank you both for being with us on this debate. Senior member of Black Alliance for Peace, Netka Freeman out of Washington, D.C., and Professor Ed Cooney and political commentator Danny Shaw, New York. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Hope to see you right here next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, he is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. وبه نستعين إنه خير ناصر ومؤين. The month is the month of Sha'ban, the month of Prophet Muhammad صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم. The occasions in which we do have some relevance to our imams, such as the birthday of imams or martyrdoms of imams, we should have some good benefits of these occasions in seeking proximity to God and performing our responsibility and duties toward these imams. And the one who is aware of his own personality and his relationship to his own imam can take benefit more of these occasions. Then let us focus on ourselves, focus on the day and night that we are in, and seek God's forgiveness, mercy, and blessings through our imams, especially Imam al-Husayn alayhi salatu wassalam. Talking about the personality of Imam al-Husayn is not so easy for me, because Imam is such a notion. We cannot talk about the depth of this personality. But to the extent of our own understanding, we can talk a little bit about his characteristics and nobility, and take our own benefit to the extent of our own perception of this imam. Just one point I want to focus on, and then to go next to that point and come to an end, inshallah, at the end, good conclusion I want to mention. Imam had many, many characteristics, and you all know about most of them. I don't want to talk about these things. Just one issue is very important for me in the life of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salatu wassalam, and that is his generosity. For the one who is going to satisfy the needs of people is to pay in a way that you're not be, you know, known person. You have to be unknown when you pay. It's the best way of paying. For that reason, what we have in the tradition of imams, they did that action over the, you know, nights and over the hours that nobody, you know, knew them or understand that these are imams. You have to pay unknowingly. And sometimes people used to come to the door of Imam al-Husayn asking something. And once Imam saw that a person, you know, looking at the face of Imam al-Husayn and asking needs, and he said, "Do not ask me directly like this." Because Imam saw that he's violating his honor in this way. "Please write your needs down, so that I can read and give you something." Because of, you know, protecting his honor, he's saying it's better to write it down instead of saying directly. "Do not ask me face to face. Rather write it down. It's better for you." Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajahum. And in the other occasion, it is a very famous story. One needy person came to the door of Imam, and Imam hided himself behind the door and just handed something to the needy person without showing himself. Because he was thinking about the honor and the personality of that person, not to be violated in this way. If you are a generous person, it's better to pay and to give only for the sake of God, not for the sake of yourself. To be unknown, not to be known. It's better to pay through some people with the mediation, not you yourself directly. It is the best, you know, generosity that Imam practiced that. An imam practiced generosity in all his life. And the best and the perfect generosity imam did was on the day of Ashura in the battle of Karbala. He gave all he had for the sake of God. His life, his companions' lives, his relatives' lives, the dignity of his family. So all of them are given for the sake of God. So nothing remained for Hussein at that time. This is the perfect generosity that the one can see in history. Imam did that. Then Allah is going to compensate that action Imam did. What Allah did, you know, before that action Imam did for the martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. These are very, very interesting things that I don't want to take your time more, but these are something done by God, you know, in front of Imam al-Hussein's martyrdom. First, after martyrdom, Imam al-Hussein became Thar Allah, the one whose revenge or revenger is Allah himself. Allah took the responsibility of his revenge for himself, by himself. I am the revenger of al-Hussein because of his martyrdom, not anybody else. So he is the Thar Allah. This is one thing. The other way Allah compensated that, in different occasions, he encouraged people through prophet and imams to go to visit Imam al-Hussein's grave. In every occasion he mentioned, even in the night of Qadr, in which Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam was martyred, in that night we do have visitation of Imam al-Hussein. In every feast days, holy days of Islam, it is mentioned it's better to go to visit Imam al-Hussein. If you cannot go to the near, you know, visitation, then it is enough ziyarah from distance. Stay here, stay whatever you are, you live, and just face yourself and your face toward Karbala by saying, As-salamu alayka ya Aba Abdullah al-Hussein. So this is visitation.
I'm looking back throughout the years to breathe is hard and my eyes are choked with tears. Your face and hair are full of light. Now it will soon be time to go. I feel you feeling calm now. Did the angel let you know?
Imam al-Hussein is the most generous imam, and we can ask our needs. We can talk about our difficulties today, and inshallah he will give us much more than our needs. Oh Allah, for the sake of this imam, please forgive our sins and please put us among real Shia of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, and among the helpers of Imam al-Mahdi, ajjalallahu ta'ala farajahu al-sharif, wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Prosperous is he,
prosperous is he,
who spends his wealth on the poor and needy, who speaks a kind word to kin and neighbor, ever grateful for Allah's favor. Guided is he,
guided is he,
who prays Allah with punctuality. Early morning tahajjud he prays, for Allah's pleasure and nearness he craves. Blessed is he,
blessed is he,
who sings Allah's praises fervently. Blessed be all of Allah's slaves. Allah's mercy be with them always. Fortunate is he,
fortunate is he,
who remembers Allah abundantly. Worldly distractions cannot mildly sway his thoughts of Allah and Judgment Day.
The United States and China have held their first high-level in-person talk since President Joe Biden entered the Oval Office in Alaska on Thursday. The growing rift between the two nations was made evident before the media as diplomats traded barbs during the opening session, a formal function in diplomatic talks that's supposed to take minutes, which in this case lasted for an hour. U.S. State Secretary Antony Blinken said the issue of Hong Kong, Taiwan, cyber attacks on United States, blame on China, and what he called Beijing's economic coercion toward Washington's allies would be discussed during the two-day talks. In response, China's top diplomat Yang Jiechi slammed the U.S. for interfering in Beijing's internal affairs. The official also lashed out at Washington for what he called its struggling democracy and poor treatment of minorities. He also sharply criticized the U.S. foreign and trade policy. Blinken accused China of grandstanding during the public meeting, while his Chinese counterpart Wang Yi slammed the U.S., quote, inhospitality.
I think that the Chinese representatives were not expecting a friendly meeting, but I think we're surprised by the how intensely aggressive and hostile the statements were coming from the U.S. side. The Biden administration's attitude toward China and orientation toward China is even more hostile and belligerent and aggressive than was Trump. And every day there's something new.
Experts also believe the first major meeting between the two superpowers suggests that a reset of ties is not in the cards for the foreseeable future. During the bitter talks, the United States accused China of human rights violations. The Chinese foreign minister was quick to respond. He noted that the U.S. no longer has the qualification to speak to China from a position of strength, adding that many Americans have little confidence in the U.S. democracy.
In the United States, police kill over 1,100 people on the average year, and that's over the last 6 years. That's three a day. There's no other advanced capitalist country, developed capitalist country, that comes even close. Canada's the next one. And the U.S. rate is four times Canada's, but it's 27 times the rate in Germany and 67 times the rate of police killing in England and Wales. So those are very serious violations of human rights. There's great poverty in large sections of the U.S. and no prospects for getting better. That's a violation of human rights. So this very condescending attitude that the U.S. representatives are taking, and their idea that they can lecture others about human rights in the world, is I think much refuted by people all over the world, the governments and people all over the world today.
As part of his go-it-alone policy, former U.S. President Donald Trump provoked an all-out trade war with China, imposing several rounds of tariffs against billions of dollars worth of Chinese imports, a move that Beijing retaliated. The Trump administration also sanctioned several Chinese officials and major companies over a variety of different allegations, ranging from human rights violations to threatening the U.S. national security. During the 2020 U.S. presidential campaign, Trump's fellow Republicans feared that Joe Biden would adopt a soft stance on China. However, top Republicans have in recent weeks voiced approval of Biden's attempts to reset relations with Washington's allies and uniting them against China. Although the Biden administration is yet to clearly define its China policy, the opening of the first major meeting between the two sides served as a preview of what lies ahead for the two nations for at least the next 4 years.
Legal filings submitted by the British law firm quote speeches where the Syrian First Lady praises the mothers of Syrian soldiers killed on the front line. It also points to interviews where she supports her husband and soldiers for defending their homeland. The law firm says The evidence compiled, in our view, legally speaking, far exceeds what may be considered reasonable comment or mere propaganda and amount to the incitement, encouragement, and or aiding and abetting of war crimes and crimes against humanity. Again, analysts question why there has been no investigation for a single politician whose country has committed war crimes, such as leaders and officials in the U.S. or the U.K. and France.
The West takes it upon itself that they can attack and invade countries at will, and everything they do is justified, even if it's based on fabricated evidence, like the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and of course the attack on Syria. This is, the United States, even under Obama, which was much better, was illegally invading countries. There was no justification, no resolution from the UN Security Council, and it was pure hypocrisy that Syria represented a threat to the United States, or this is a defensive war.
The timing of this move raises further question marks. On Monday, the UK had imposed new sanctions on 6 Syrian government officials, including the country's foreign minister. Now that the fighting has subsided in Syria and government forces have the upper hand against terror groups, any military plots to overthrow the government appear to have failed. Could the West be looking at new ideas to destabilize the country? Syria faces fresh problems today, including the spread of the coronavirus and the state of its economy. American forces are occupying the country's east, where the oil reserves are, thereby preventing Damascus from using its oil revenue to rebuild vital infrastructure. The U.S. and Israel continue to launch airstrikes. Syria also accuses the European Union of being responsible for the suffering and bloodshed of civilians, saying the bloc, along with Britain, has backed terrorist groups. Yet, civilians are starting to return to many liberated parts of their homeland, including entire provinces that had been destroyed by various terror groups. Researchers say since March 2011, Washington has led a coalition of NATO countries, Arab monarchies, and Israel in a proxy regime change war, using terrorist mercenaries as foot soldiers. Perhaps a wider investigation is needed to establish who supported the terrorists, who funded them, who backed them, who provided them with training, and who really committed war crimes in the Arab country. Britain's Metropolitan Police have opened a preliminary investigation into the wife of Syria's First Lady, Asma al-Assad. A London-based law firm has filed a complaint over allegations of incitement and encouragement to commit acts of terrorism. Asma has dual British-Syrian nationality and could reportedly lose her British citizenship and have an international arrest warrant issued if convicted. The Metropolitan Police say it received a referral in July last year relating to the ongoing Syrian conflict. In a statement, the Met says the referral is in the process of being assessed by officers from the War Crimes Unit. British media suggests police are considering whether there is enough evidence to carry out a full investigation. This is why the analysts say there is sufficient evidence to investigate former British Prime Minister Tony Blair for his leading role in the invasion of Iraq.
A total double standard. Actually, Tony Blair admitted that that George Bush was fabricating evidence against Syria. For the war, of course, Blair has been invading a country. There's no legitimate reason for that. Which plus American troops are there at the present time, and British troops are actually even in Syria and French troops for a very long period of time, which does constitute a war crime.
As a result of the invasion of Iraq, hundreds of thousands of civilians have been killed. The invasion also led to the birth of terrorist groups that had no presence in the country before. These terrorists, including Al-Qaeda and Daesh, have killed and raped locals on a mass scale and ravaged the entire country. Yet the perpetrators of the invasion and its aftermath continue to live a lavish lifestyle. On the other hand, Asma al-Assad has suffered from cancer and has paid a considerable amount being treated for the disease, which raises questions over her role in the alleged crimes committed.
The COVID-19 pandemic has been negatively affecting minorities in the UK, especially the British Muslims. The coronavirus outbreak has caused hardships for a record number of Muslims in the country, with the faith group experiencing a fall into poverty at a much higher rate than the rest of the British population. Also, the demand for help among them has doubled within a year. According to the National Zakat Foundation and Islamic Relief UK, requests for financial help have risen from about 15 per day before the first lockdown measures were introduced in the country to over 70 per day toward the end of 2020. The National Zakat Foundation says it has offered £3.8 million in grants. The figure represented a 27% increase compared to the previous year. The charitable organization offers such grants from Zakat, the obligatory religious levy collected from British Muslims.
Day in, day out, Muslims are being attacked on media by politicians of all persuasion, you know, left, right, every aspect of their lives is being associated with terrorism, with negativity, and this has an impact. I mean, this will have impact both financially and psychologically on the Muslim community. Even Muslim organizations are not really adhered or supported.
With the second Ramadan and lockdown fest approaching, the national charity says funds are still urgently needed to respond to the continuing high demand for help. With the vast majority of Zakat typically given during Ramadan, the National Zakat Foundation is now urgently seeking funds to ensure they can meet the needs of the community in the weeks and months ahead. Figures from the Muslim Census Organization reveal the community has been falling into poverty at a rate 10 times higher than the UK population. The report also revealed that job losses among British Muslims have been 6 times greater compared to the rest of the population since the pandemic began. It also showed that 42% of Muslims surveyed had used their savings to cover their expenses during the pandemic. This is compared to a recent study by AJ Bell, an investment company, which recorded that 30% of UK people have had to use their savings. As well as facing poverty, Muslim communities are especially vulnerable to coronavirus, as many live in extended households where elderly people and those with existing health conditions are most at risk. Key workers such as NHS staff and transport workers from these families also have the additional fear of catching the virus. But there are other factors involved, including health inequalities.
Muslims, due to Islamophobia, and they have become second-class citizens in their own countries, in Britain, France, Germany, and most of the Western world. And they are being discriminated. They are the first one to be fired. They are the last one to be hired.
Experts believe the problem with the UK's health system is that people aren't getting the information and support they need.
It's not something that is just happening last week or last month. It's been going on for a very long time, and nothing is being done about it. Governments, not only they're not making an attempt to stop it, they are, them themselves and the politicians, are actually contributing to ever-increasing environment of hate against Muslims.
They say, as the pandemic comes to an end, the British government needs to reinvest in services that support people's health and ensure they're culturally and linguistically inclusive and accessible to people from all communities.
A group of 17 countries have united in defense of the United Nations Charter. The group seeks to form a coalition to promote multilateralism and counter the use or the threat of force and sanctions against other UN member states. The coalition, known as the Group of Friends in Defense of the Charter of the United Nations, includes Iran, China, Russia, Palestine, Syria, Venezuela, North Korea, and Cuba, as well as several other countries. The group has called for dialogue, tolerance, and solidarity. And these are the core of international relations and vital for the peaceful coexistence among nations. The group's concept notes said unprecedented attacks against multilateralism have put the global peace and security in jeopardy. adding that imposition of coercive measures and the withdrawal from global agreements were signs of growing unilateralism. That is while all 17 members of the group were under sanctions during the former U.S. President Donald Trump's time in office. For instance, the Trump administration imposed sanctions against Iran over its peaceful nuclear program, China over alleged technology theft, and Russia over the 2014 integration of Crimea. Under Trump, Washington announced plans to quit the World Health Organization, pulled out of the UN Human Rights Council, the UN cultural agency UNESCO, the Paris Climate Change Accord, and the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. Trump's successor, Joe Biden, has pledged to reverse Washington's previous course as he rescinded the withdrawal from the World Health Organization and returned the U.S. to the Paris Climate Change Agreement. However, Biden has maintained the sanctions already in place against Iran, as well as against Cuba, Venezuela, North Korea, Syria, and other countries involved in the 17-party group of friends, proving that Washington has no plans to put an end to its hostile and illegal sanctions.
I think it's a very significant move. The United States announced after President Biden's inauguration that we were back on the world scene. And I think expected that everybody would make a sigh of relief and everything would be fine. But I don't think that's quite what's happened here. The Chinese and the Russians and, 17 other nations or more have signed this declaration to work through the United Nations to end the kind of unilateralism, unilateral interference in foreign affairs. Clearly, that's aimed at the United States.
Members of the Group of Friends coalition have railed against Washington's sanctions and intervention in various statements. A good example of Washington's unilateralism is its withdrawal from the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. The U.S. left the deal unilaterally and rescinded hundreds of sanctions against Tehran. Since the U.N. Security Council Resolution 1737 was passed in 2006, the U.S. and the European Union have been the biggest supporters of sanctions against Iran in order to hamper its peaceful nuclear program. They have both passed numerous bills to impose ever harsher sanctions, including Washington's failed maximum pressure campaign. Last month, Iran's Foreign Minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, said the U.S. sanctions against Iran have inflicted the country's economy with $1 trillion worth of damage. China has repeatedly called on the U.S. to stop its illegal unilateral sanctions on Iran. Meanwhile, Russia has slammed the anti-Iran sanctions by Washington, calling them anti-human. However, despite being a failed policy, Washington continues its futile approach. According to the report published by the Cost of War Project at Brown University's Watson Institute and USA Today, the U.S. military has been in over 85 countries in the past 3 years. U.S. troops have conducted bombing or ground attacks in 10 countries, including Afghanistan, Yemen, Syria, Iraq, Kenya, Libya, Mali, Nigeria, Pakistan, and Somalia over the same period.
After all, if we talk about the Middle East, it was the United States who withdrew from the nuclear accords. That's an act of hostility. And then to blame the Iranians and say, unless they do something, we're not going to come back. I mean, this is the kind of double standard we face. And it is one that's going to have to be overcome politically in this country before there's going to be a change.
A recent report by the Washington Post revealed that the U.S. has attempted to change other nations' governments 72 times between the years 1947 and 1989 during the Cold War. Finally, when the U.S. continues to apply sanctions for its own political gains and gets away with it, or when the Israeli regime breaks the most U.N. resolutions, essentially making the resolutions ineffective, doesn't that put the U.N. institution's purpose under question?
Thank you. Congratulations to everyone who celebrates Nowruz. We congratulate all Iranians and Persian-speaking peoples of the world on the occasion of Nowruz.
In the limelight.
CO2 is not a lone actor. When you consider the whole cast of other characters, the outlook in the Amazon is that the impacts of human activities will be worse than we realize. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jessica Corbett Ryder. This article is published under the heading, "We're Destroying Our Life Support Systems. Studies suggest the Amazon now contributes to warming." Stay tuned for the details, please. While recent research has raised alarm that tropical forests, including the Amazon, could soon stop serving as carbon sinks, a first-of-its-kind study from 30 experts that takes into account other greenhouse gases suggests the world's largest rainforests may already be contributing to the warming of the planet. The new analysis, published recently in the journal Frontiers in Forest and Global Change, considers not only carbon dioxide, CO2, and its impact on the global climate, but also that of methane, CH4, nitrous oxide, N20, black carbon, biogenic volatile organic compounds, BVOCs, aerosols, evapotranspiration, and albedo. What the authors do that's important is to expand the conversation beyond carbon dioxide, which is what 90% of public conversation is centered around. Patrick McGonigal, Associate Director of Research at Smithsonian Environmental Research Center, told National Geographic, CO2 is not a lone actor, added McGonigal, who was cited in but not involved with the research, which was funded by the National Geographic Society. When you consider the whole cast of other characters, the outlook in the Amazon is that the impacts of human activities will be worse than we realize. As 15-year-old climate activist Alexandria Villasnor put it in a tweet about the study, we are destroying our life support systems. We are running out of time. The recent study notes that after a transient period of reduced deforestation and increased optimism, rising agricultural conversion and illegal logging activities are again accelerating Amazonian forest loss. This resurgence has renewed concerns that the region is rapidly approaching a catastrophic tipping point. Data from the Rainforest Foundation Norway revealed recently that human activities have destroyed 34% of old-growth tropical rainforest and degraded 30% worldwide. Over half of that destruction since 2002 has been in the Amazon and neighboring South American rainforest. Under Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro, whose country is home to the majority of the Amazon, deforestation hit a 12-year high in 2020. Cutting the forest is interfering with its carbon uptake. That's a problem. Christopher Covey, lead author of the new study and a professor of environmental studies at Skidmore College, told National Geographic. But when you start to look at these other factors alongside CO2, it gets really hard to see how the net effect isn't that the Amazon as a whole is really warming global climate. The study says that despite some uncertainty, we conclude that current warming from non-CO2 agents, especially CH4 and N2O in the Amazon basin, largely offsets and most likely exceeds the climate service provided by atmospheric CO2 uptake. We also find that the majority of anthropogenic impacts act to increase the radioactive forcing potential of the basin. Given the large contribution of less recognized agents, the paper continues, noting that Amazonian trees alone emit about 3.5% of all global CH4, focusing strictly on carbon uptake and storage is incompatible with genuine efforts to understand and manage the biochemistry of climate in a rapidly changing Amazon basin. Covey and his colleagues told National Geographic that reversing the damage that's already been done will require halting emissions from fossil fuels around the world and reining in Amazon deforestation, along with reducing dam building and increasing efforts to replant trees. The Amazon is among the most biodiverse places on the planet. The ongoing coronavirus pandemic has highlighted the importance of conserving and restoring rainforest, not only because of the climate emergency, but also to prevent future zoonotic disease outbreaks. As the pandemic, officially declared a year ago, has killed more than 2.6 million people and sickened over 119 million worldwide, experts from across the globe have repeatedly called on humanity to heal its broken relationship with nature.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Brothers and sisters, you are listening to The Lantern, only from IRIB English Radio. Thank you so very much for being with us and sharing with us your precious time. We're going to spend minutes today to talk about some matters and point that the current society is dealing with now, some issues that the society is facing now more than ever. I don't want to call it a problem, but it is a problem. And it's the issue and problem of celebrities. Let's listen to a short audio clip that our producers have prepared for us. And we're going to continue with our discussion afterwards, so stay tuned. Mm-hmm.
Heroes and Celebrities is the title of today's story. Back in the 20th century, there was a British song that repeated over and over again the claim that there were no more heroes anymore. Calmer critics and social commentators have agreed that the age of the heroes is over. In the past, people had heroes. The myth of the hero, though, could not survive when public life came to be dominated by the mass media. The mass media killed off the heroes and replaced them with celebrities. The mass media is not solely responsible for the death of the hero. The democratic culture also undermined the ideas that certain individuals carry a divine spark and are therefore superior to that of the rest of us. The critical gaze of the psychologist and sociologist have also entered public consciousness. The drives of a great individual are seen to have their roots in an unhappy youth, an obsession with his mother, and his great ambition is said to stem from an early inability to simply hang out with the boys and have a good time. Having killed the hero, we have replaced him with a distinctively modern public figure, the celebrity. As one commentator put it, the celebrity is a person who is known for being well-known. Any exposure in the media helps to increase someone's status as a celebrity. Celebrities offer exclusive stories to increase their exposure. The media promote them to increase their rating, and we collude by paying so much attention to the glossy features, the exclusive interviews, and the various scandals and intrigues. They have no reason to object to invasion of their private lives because this just keeps their names on everyone's lips, which is all that really matters. To become a celebrity is more important to have a good press agent than it is to be a big achiever, which is one of the reasons why figures from the worlds of light, entertainment, and sports are some of the most successful celebrities. With cleverly crafted media events in which managers collaborate with magazine editors and program directors, it is possible to give these figures a level of exposure which is out of all proportion to their actual achievements. For many people, the heroes of the past were an inspiration. They broadened our horizons by giving us an example of a course of action that could be considered noble. Celebrities, on the other hand, with that string of stories about their hardships and their lucky breaks, their affairs and their breakups, prove to be nothing out of the ordinary. Reading about their lives does not inspire us or fill us with purpose.
Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
In Islam, we are taught that we're taught to do good, but to do it in silence, to do it in stealth mode, you know? To do it discreetly without taking pictures of it and posting it on social media. We do good so that we can be rewarded by God, so that we can get closer to them, to Him, and to be better people. So we're either doing good for that, or we're doing good to be famous, which well totally contradicts with what Islam teaches us and how Islam wants us to be. Or we could be on the other side of the spectrum and we could be a scandalous person, as they say, and constantly stir up sedition and controversy and be known for being reckless and mischievous and being a troublemaker and a nuisance to society and want to gain fame through that. And that's also wrong. One of the social sins is to sin publicly and to propagate sinning. So either way, no matter how we look at it, in an Islamic worldview and according to the teachings of Islam, there is nothing that we can do that would allow us to attract fame and the status of celebrity toward ourselves, for ourselves. Because in a monotheistic ideology, human beings, which, well, we can't argue that the desire for approval and affirmation is an innate quality of every human being. We all seek it. We all try to pursue it in life. As parents, we're supposed to approve of our children and give them affirmation from a young age to build character, to give them confidence, to let them know that they are valid, to let them know that they are recognized, so that when they grow older and they step into society, they don't constantly look for validation from other human beings. And even if some people, that's why we see so many people on social media, we see people on the news, we see people in, you know, in our society that will do anything, pull off any sort of stunt in order to get that validation from others, right? So it's totally natural for us to want that. But Islam teaches us that, look, I know you have this natural desire within you. What you have to try to do, however, is to receive that validation only from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Because at the end of the day, that's the only validation that counts. You could be doing the rightest thing in the world, the most correct, righteous, upright, humane, just thing in the world, and it could not sit well with man-made standards. And they would deem your action as corrupt and unfair, and they would label you as an unfavorable person. We see that so much in today's society, where some quote-unquote celebrities, for whatever the reason, don't say very favorable things about supposedly LGBTQ, and they get canceled entirely because, well, in the time space that we're living right now, LGBTQ is a social value and it's a human right. Go figure, right? But in the eyes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, it's a grave sin. So if a lecturer or a preacher goes out on a pulpit and talks against LGBTQ, he's going to be massacred, right? But is that the criteria he's going to select for himself in order to, for the things that he chooses to say and the things he chooses to preach to society about? Or is Allah's validation what he's looking for in life? There's so much more to talk about regarding celebrity and the status of celebrity and why people yearn for it and what's the difference between being a celebrity and a hero and role model and this and that. But unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today's episode of The Lantern. Until another greeting, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
ألا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.